Hello and welcome to Books of the Year, another podcast from your very favourite vendor of books podcasts. Books of the Year.
That is true, and we are in the unusual position at the moment of our guest hasn't quite turned up, so here's hoping he rocks up whilst we're reading this introduction.
Well, if he doesn't, then you're not going to hear this.
You won't hear this.
He's here.
Oh, he's here. Oh, brilliant. Okay.
An email from Celeste in Guildford. Dear Bookends, the nights are drawing in, and as a habitual seasonal reader, I'm looking for some great book recommendations to curl up with by the fire. I always seem to go back to the same books and authors, Shirley Jackson, Emily Bronte, Arthur Miller. But this year, I want a new stack of winter warmers. Can you or any of your listeners help? Love the pod, says Celeste. That's interesting. My books do not alter by the season.
No.
At all.
No. Well, I tell you, I mean, interestingly, normally I read Ian Rankin's books at Christmas. That's normally my sort of thing, is our sort of Christmas evening and Boxing Day. I spend
wrap up warm with Ian
Rankin. Yes, that's exactly what I do. So this year, obviously we've read this in October, so I don't know what I'm going to read at Christmas now. That's about the only thing that I read that I know I will be reading at a certain part of the year.
If you have seasonal reading, then maybe you can help Celeste. Shirley Jackson, Emily Bronte, Arthur Miller, she gets that.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else?
Glyn in Worcester emails to say, Dear Simon and Matt, I'm a long-time listener and have read many of your brilliant recommendations. My most recent Books of the Year rec was You Are Here by David Nichols, which I thoroughly enjoyed. I thought I'd share one of my own, which I don't believe has been featured on your podcast, Bourneville by Jonathan Coe.
No, it's true, we haven't.
No. It's a couple of years old now, I think. I thought it was fab. It's a State of the Nation novel, great humour, also a serious message. I hadn't read anything by this author before, but we'll now be going through his backlist. Keep up the good work. Have you read any Jonathan Coe?
I have read a couple of Jonathan Coe books, actually, but I haven't read Bourneville, so we'll consider that an addition to our pile. If you'd like to get in touch, you can email booksoftheyear@yahoo.com. We're on Instagram and Threads at Pick Any Page, clinging onto the wreckage of Twitter at Books of the Year, and also I'm on Blue Sky. Matt will be there eventually.
Eventually.
Ian Rankin's there as well, so I'm going to ask him about that. Speaking of whom, here he is. So Sirian is with us. This is Sirian Rankin. Congratulations, by the way, Sirian.
Yeah, you can stop saying that.
We'll keep saying Sirian now.
It sort of flows to Ian McKellen, doesn't it? Sirian
does.
McKellen,
yeah.
That's what
it
also sounds like Sirian. It sounds like I'm a Syrian refugee or something.
Okay. So just on the question that Celeste brought up about being a seasonal reader, would you be a seasonal reader? Are there books that or authors that you would go to at particular times of the year?
I think there are books I like to curl up with, or a type of book I like to curl up with when it's cold and it's dark outside, which is most of the year in Scotland, to be honest with you. Give me some Simenon, or I can reread Anthony Pohl's A Dance to the Music of Time, 12 short novels, a little bit of Graham Greene maybe. Mm-hmm. And if the weather is particularly inclement, I will reach for Gilly Cooper's Rivals.
Mm.
What is it? I don't think I've read that. So
you've not read Gilly Cooper's Rivals?
No. Oh no, you've talked about Gilly Cooper
Come
before.
On. Yeah, so, it's on the telly now. I think it's coming up on the telly, but I only have council telly, so I don't think I'll get to see it.
Council telly?
Yeah.
Is that what you
three called? Channels. Three channels, mate.
What's Bruce Springsteen's song? Three channels and nothing on.
Nothing on,
yeah. I was just going through our socials and I was talking about being on Blue Sky and all that kind of stuff. What are you happy still populating various different bits of social media? Have you changed what you like to do or the importance of it? Or
I wish I could wean myself off it completely. Yeah. I mean, I'm a bit of a nerd that way. I remember when I was on eBay looking at vinyl, and I would just scroll and scroll and scroll and scroll to the vinyl for sale for hours upon hours. And I managed to wean myself off that and then seemed to get onto Twitter instead. And I'm trying desperately to wean myself off that. But then there are so many alternatives. You go, which one works? You know, and if you're trying to promote something,
yes,
which one is going to work for you? So I'm on Blue Sky, I'm on Threads, I'm on Instagram, I'm on Facebook, I'm still on X. And I do it all. I've not got a PA or a secretary. It takes time and it's a bit of a time suck. So I will wean myself off it eventually. I'll have a digital detox over Christmas and curl up with a good book.
I reckon you'll pop up somewhere because it's a hard, it's not only is it a hard habit to break, but it's also quite useful sometimes in introducing you to new people and interesting ideas.
Not just not new people, but reintroducing you to old people. I've met up with a lot of old school friends and university friends via Facebook, for example. Some distant cousin of mine got in touch recently on social media and said, oh, I went to visit your granddad's grave in France from World War One, and I'd never seen a photograph of where my granddad was buried before. I had no idea where my granddad was buried before. This is my dad's dad. He didn't come back from World War One, so there's a photograph of the grave, and here's the village that he's buried in. And then he said, oh, I've also managed to find a photograph of your granddad in his uniform, and here's a photograph of your grandma. And I'm 64 years old, and I'd never seen a photograph of my grandparents. Until this distant cousin showed me it via social media.
That's astonishing.
It is. It's brilliant. And now I'm determined I'm going to go to France before I die and see where my grandfather is buried.
All of which is an introduction to, well, it's not really an introduction,
not
it's
really
a preamble, but
it's where our listeners
led us. So thank you, and you can email at any time. Cerie and Rankin is here because Midnight in Blue is the latest, but in fact, we're speaking on the day that you're on the front page of the Times, saying that, I'm sure you'll provide some context, that no crime novel should be longer than 300 pages.
Yeah, can I give you some context
for
that?
I was at
a Cheltenham Literature Festival, and I was interviewed, and I don't know how it came up, but it came up about length of books, and you know, as I get older, my books are getting shorter. The books I write are getting shorter because I always think I might peg it before I finish writing the book. So the books are definitely getting shorter. But also, I enjoy reading shorter books because, again, I would hope to finish the book before I curl up my toes. And, you know, for the past 20, 30 years, there's been a tendency for novels to get longer and longer. But some of my favourite books are incredibly short books, and some of the best crime novels ever written are incredibly short books. They're under 200 pages. And I'm kind of veering that way now. You know, I think about 300 pages is the right length for a novel. And my heart sinks sometimes when a 600-page novel arrives from the publisher who wants a blurb for it, because that's 200-300-page novels I'm not going to read while I'm reading a 600-page novel. Don't look at me like that. And your novels are not that long.
No, they're not.
Your novels are not that long. Not yet. Yeah, so it was a kind of, it was a throwaway glib comment. It was slightly tongue-in-cheek. I did say lots of caveats. I said a lot of my favourite novels and crime novels have been very long. In fact, possibly my crime novel of this year, which is Dominic Nolan's White City, which I think is published in November, is, I think, about 450, and it's terrific. I loved it to bits. Very much a British James Ellroy. But yeah, I do prefer short books, and when I find a new writer and their books are fairly short, I go, hooray.
The Times journalist made a point of saying that Knots and Crosses, your first book, was 168 pages.
Yeah.
So you're getting shorter than you have been, but you're longer than you used to be.
Yeah. Yeah. I remember when I wrote the first novel. My first novel, The Flood, was 160. Knots and Crosses was about 170. And then I wrote a spy novel called Watchmen, which was about 195. And I remember writing in my diary, I cannot conceive of writing a book that is longer than 200 pages. But that was in the days before computers. I was writing this on a kind of portable typewriter.
It was
hard work.
Yeah.
And to change it, to tweak it, to make corrections was hard work. So you didn't want to be stuck there for 500 pages.
Where do we find Rebus at the start of Midnight in Blue?
In jail. I wasn't going to write this book. I thought the previous book was a great ending to the series, a Reichenbach Falls moment, Rebus on trial, sentence about to be pronounced, the end. But readers were furious with me for doing that, and they said, we need to know what happened in that courtroom. And I thought, well, what did happen in the courtroom? He's found guilty. What happens if he's found guilty? He's going to go to prison. Oh, that's interesting. An ex-cop in prison, surrounded by people who hate his guts because he was an ex-cop or because he put them in there. So he's going to have to watch his back and his front. What happens if there's a murder in the prison? That could get very interesting indeed. So it just sort of came together like that. It came together from me thinking, oh, what would happen to Rebus? He'd be found guilty. He'd be put in jail. What would happen to him in jail? He would start acting like a cop.
And what, remind us, so he's guilty of?
He's guilty of murdering a big Edinburgh gangster called Big Ger Cafferty, Maurice Gerald Cafferty, who has been his nemesis for many, many books, his Moriarty, his Mr. Hyde, however you want to put it. And he didn't die. at the end of the draft I submitted, the book was called Heart Full of Headstones, and when I submitted it to my agent, Cafferty lived. He survived the attack. But my agent said, no, I think he goes. I think this is it. This is his Waterloo, as it were. And so I looked at the ending again, and I looked at the book, and I thought about it and thought about it, and I thought, well, maybe he's right. Maybe for once I'm going to do what I'm told by my agent and bump off one of my main characters, a character I loved writing about.
So, but it feels slightly unfair because Rebus didn't really kill him. Or it doesn't appear to.
Well, Rebus's defence is that he only meant to give him a fright by stuffing a pillow over his face and holding it there for a while. And Cafferty was alive when Rebus left the room, but Cafferty then almost immediately afterwards suffered a heart attack from which he did not recover. So Rebus is, while he's in prison, is appealing, but he's finding it very hard to get in touch with his lawyers. So he thinks that the appeal is going nowhere. It's going nowhere fast. So yeah, so he's on tenterhooks, waiting for his lawyers to get back to him. But meantime, he's in prison. And I thought I'd fallen at the first hurdle, because when I went for a tour of the prison in Edinburgh with the governor, who was about to retire, gave me a tour. And he was very open, I think, because he was about to retire. Lots of great anecdotes from him. Anyway, he said, oh, he wouldn't come here. You wouldn't put an Edinburgh cop in an Edinburgh prison. Too dangerous for him. He would go to Inverness or Dumfries. And I thought, well, I don't especially want him to go to Inverness or Dumfries. I want him to be in Edinburgh, so he's quite close to all my other detectives and characters that I use in the books. So I said, well, look, what if he was here? He said, well, he'd be in this kind of special isolation wing, which is for prisoners who are either a threat to the general population in the jail or else would be under threat if they were in the general population. And also high-profile offenders would be kept in this wing. And so I went and looked at that wing and I thought, yeah, this is okay, but I really need Rebus in the general prison population. So I found a way to do that.
Yeah.
And hopefully convincingly, but having sent a copy to the governor, he's not got back to me yet.
So just one other point, just to establish the parameters of the book. So there is murder. Obviously, Rebus is the man on the inside, but outside there is another case for Rebus's ex-colleagues, I suppose you could call them, to investigate.
It was going to be a very short book if it was only the prison story, and also it was going to be incredibly claustrophobic for me to write. The murder in the prison, I asked the governor and he said, oh, CID would come in and investigate that. So I thought, oh, that's great. I've got cops coming in who Rebus knows. They then go outside. So we're outside the prison getting some fresh air, as it were, the readers, that is. And then I thought, I need another case. And I thought, I'll have a missing persons case. A teenage girl's gone missing. That's being investigated by Siobhan Clark, Rebus's one-time colleague. That gives her something to do in the book. But also it takes us in a different place where it frees me up to write about the Edinburgh outside the prison walls. And also Rebus gets hold of a burner phone, which means at dead of night he can call up people like Siobhan Clark and these other colleagues and ask him how everything's going and see if he can help. And he gets to listen to the sounds of the outside world, which I actually found quite moving to write. You know, he says, hey, are you in a pub? What are you drinking? What does it taste like? Are you outside in the rain now? Is it raining? I've not smelt rain for ages. So all the things that he misses come back to haunt him in this book, including, to a certain extent, Maurice Gerald Cafferty.
The least surprising news for anyone who's ever listened to this podcast is that I love the book and I devoured it very, very quickly. Absolutely inhaled this book. And I got to the end and I'd not seen books doing this before, but right at the end, there's a list of your former books, your older books. And obviously, you normally get that right at the front of a book, and it's just a list of the titles. And my problem is that I can never remember the story of a book from just the title. However, at the back of the book is not only the titles, but very, very brief synopsis of each of those books. And I went through them and I realised, oh my God, that's the book so the first of yours that I read was Black and Blue. Mm. And I remember me and the woman who would become my wife, us going on holiday with that book. And then the next one, I was going, oh, that was the one where we were on our honeymoon. And this is the one where we were on holiday. And this is the one from Christmas from 4 years ago. And it struck me then that the premise of this book felt completely new, because as you've already described, we've got a murder in the prison, and it's effectively a locked room murder, and we're not even sure where the murder weapon is, because this is a prison. How on earth have they got a murder weapon, and where is it now? Also, the way this person's been killed, there should have been a lot of blood, and there's hardly any blood, so how has that happened? And was this? Am I right, first of all, to think that this is the first sort of locked room murder you've done, and what drew you to doing that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm a fan of locked room mysteries in general ever since Edgar Allan Poe did Murders in the Rue Morgue. I just think it's a fantastic trick that the author plays on the readers, and an impossible murder. I wasn't sure I could pull it off, but I just thought, oh, you're in a prison. If somebody's murdered in a locked cell, that is a locked room mystery straight away. So the prison doors are, the cell doors are unlocked first thing in the morning. There's a body there. As you say, there should be more blood. There's no murder weapon. The officers, prison officers, all think it must be an inmate. The inmates all think it must be a prison officer. So suddenly the place is a powder keg. The whole prison is a powder keg. And here's the guy in the middle, Rebus, who can maybe solve the mystery. So I just loved it. But when I started writing the book, I didn't know who the killer was. Mm. And I didn't know how they did it. I thought, I'll work this out later. Just get started, Ian.
Because I was going to ask, because that's what you always say that you do.
Though.
You just start.
Yeah. 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 And I just thought back to the cell that I'd seen when I visited the prison. And I thought back to the machinations of how you run a wing of a prison, and the amount of cameras and CCTV, and how many guards there are. How could this happen? How could this work? And I just found a solution about, I guess, maybe halfway through the book. I suddenly realised who did it and how. You see, the thing is, I'm sure I've said this before, but maybe not on your programme. If I don't know who did it, you probably don't know as a reader who did it.
That's
you know,
true.
You know. And sometimes it's a second draft of the book before I work out what's going on. Hanging Garden, I finished the first draft still not knowing who the killer was. I just had these blank spaces to be filled in at a later date. And it was only through reading the first draft carefully that I realised, oh, it was you because of X, Y, and Z. So that's just the way I work, if you can call it work.
It's a very personal book for Rebus, I think. We learned quite a lot about him. I guess we learned something about him in all of the books, but maybe you've hinted at it because he's asking questions about the outside, about the sounds and about the smells and all the things that he's missing. But he also goes to the prison library. And I think you tell us that the librarian is surprised that he has a wide knowledge of authors, though he seldom finishes a book. But also Thomas Harris and Michael Connolly, who's going to be on this show very shortly, get a mention. What's your thinking around Rebus and a library and his reading habits?
Well, in the early books, he is a reader. He's got piles of unread and half-read books sitting around his chair. I reckon he still is a reader, although I toned down a number of mentions of other people's books. But when I was I did go to the prison library, which is run by Edinburgh City Council. It's a proper librarian who runs it, and prisoners help out. And I thought, well, Rebus has probably read more books than most of the people in this library, or at least he knows about writers more than most people in this prison. So maybe he would get a job at the prison library. And while I was in the library, I mean, two things they said. One was that people like Thomas Harris and Michael Connolly are very popular. The second thing they said to me was, Ian, can you get us some foreign language editions of your books? Because we have foreign language prisoners in here and we can't find books for them to read. So I took in a bunch of Romanian and Polish books, editions of the Rebus. They said, Vietnamese, you got any Vietnamese? I don't think I do have Vietnamese. So that was really interesting to me. So I went back to the prison a couple of weeks ago to talk to some of the prisoners at the behest of the librarian. And that was fascinating again. I thought I'd better go before the book is published. I might not be quite as welcome once the staff and the prisoners read what I've said about them.
I found hope and compassion in this book, which I was surprised at, given we're in a prison. And often, obviously, for good reason, these places seem to be swamped in despair. And it reminded me a little of watching, I'm a massive fan of Jimmy McGovern, and he did two series called Time, one set in a male prison, one set in a female prison. And again, there I saw hope and compassion. How important was it to you to bring those into this book?
Every book for me is me having a kind of argument with Rebus about the way the world is. I mean, he's an Old Testament sort of guy. He sees everything in polarities, good and evil. Once you're a villain, you're always a villain. There's no chance for redemption. And putting him in jail gave me the chance to show him that people can change, that there are people in prison who probably shouldn't be there, not necessarily because they're innocent, but because they should be in some kind of care facility. They've got mental health issues or whatever, or just general health issues. But for whatever reasons, there's nowhere for them to go. And of course, there are some people in prison who cannot readjust to the outside world. They need the structure that prison gives them. And so they reoffend once they're out, just so they can go back into prison. So I gave all of these things to Rebus. And, you know, I think one of the prisoners early on says to me, maybe it's the wizard, the oldest of the prisoners in the facility, who says to him something like, you know, you've met us now. Do you think we're baddies? You know, do you think we're just all baddies? And I think Rebus does change his mind in the course of this book. I think that's where that sense of compassion comes in. And you've got good people. You've got people in the educational sphere who go in there to try and to teach literacy, for example, so that prisoners come out, they've got a better chance of getting a job and therefore not reoffending. You've got prison visits are made as easy as it can be. You can do it by video if your family live a long way away. You get little booths that you can go into. You've got health. You've got the NHS provide nursing staff. So Rebus gets his inhaler because he has COPD. Although the nurse did tell me he's going to have to protect that because prisoners will try and steal it from him. I said, why? She said, to use it as a bong. I thought that's going in the book. That's that's a kind of detail I'll live and die by. All of that I found absolutely fascinating, and I thought this is going to change Rebus's mind. He's going to be less of an Old Testament guy, a guy who sees the world in terms of absolutes, and he's going to be much more like me.
Right?
Does that make this a surprising book for you as the author?
Oh yeah. Oh, I mean, this was a huge challenge. I mean, the easy route would just be to do another Rebus book on the outside world or to do a different kind of book. But to do this, I thought, wow, this is a very, you know, it's such an intimate space in which things will happen. And and you've got all these characters who are having to, there's a hierarchy in jail. I mean, this is the thing about Rebus, is he needs hierarchies and he needs an institutional surroundings. He worked in the army when he left school. That's an institution, as it were. Then he joined the police, again, as a hierarchy, rules to be followed. And then now he's in prison, same thing. Prisons can only operate through these almost unspoken rules. And the first thing I do in this book is show you the hierarchy. They're queuing up for breakfast. And at the head of the queue are the nutcases. You know, the people who, if you try and get past them in the queue, are going to do you. So they're at the head of the queue. The important people, like the gangsters, are at the head of the queue. Further back are the lifers who've been there for a while. They've got a certain amount of respect. Further back are people like Rebus, who've not long arrived. And that sort of thing, prison wouldn't operate without an unspoken agreement between the staff and the inmates that we're not going to go off on one this time. And during the night shift, I found in some jails, including Edinburgh, there could be as few as 12 staff for the whole jail. And I just thought, that's extraordinary, because you've got 800, 900 men in this jail. Actually, people, sorry. There's a women's wing as well, which I didn't go to. You've got about 900 people being looked after by 12.
And that hierarchy you've just described for the dinner queue, that wasn't your creation? That's one that exists?
No, well, that was my creation. I mean, nobody told me that. I just thought, I bet that's the way it is. Mm. I bet that's the way it is. I don't think anybody mentioned that to me. But a lot of the stuff that got mentioned in passing went into the book. The colour coordination, or the colour coding they have for the tops that they wear to show if they're a lifer, a sex offender, on remand, whatever it is. All of that went into the book. It's as realistic as it can be. The only thing that's really unrealistic is that someone like Rebus would not be in there in the first place. Yeah.
You touched on the staffing, and not just the staffing of the prison service, but the staffing of the police is a kind of an underground theme that's going all the way through this book. And the lack of numbers.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, it's a huge problem. I mean, everybody who watches crime shows on television think you've got as many cops as you need and you've got as much money as you need to solve a case. You've got all the tech that you need and everything else. But it just ain't so. And especially in post-COVID days, a lot of people are not at work for whatever reason. And then you get really stretched and people end up doing double shifts. When they do double shifts, they get irascible. and they get lazy, or they don't get lazy, but they make mistakes. So all of that, I think, is contained in this. In the sense that everybody's stretched. Everybody is stretched to almost breaking point. And I get, you know, you look around you on a day-to-day basis in any place in the UK, people are just, a lot of people are at breaking point.
You're talking about institutions. You reminded me of a conversation. When Stephen Fry had the first bit of his memoir came out, Moab is my washpot, as I recall. And he goes to prison because he nicked some stuff. And he said he found prison easier than others because he'd been at private school. He'd been at boarding school. And it was the institution. He was institutionalized at boarding school, therefore going to prison. He was in another institution. And it was the same thing. Obviously, he's a different kind of guy now. But that, I found that fascinating, that if you've grown up in one institution, the swap to another institution is actually more straightforward.
Yeah, and you can finesse that. So, you know, the fact that you have linguistic ability or you have literacy, you'll end up reading letters that guys get or whatever because they've not got the skills to read, or you end up trying to teach them. I've been in prisons where prisoners who can read and write will be teaching other prisoners, mentoring other prisoners in how to read and write, using very simple, you know, using a daily newspaper or something, and just the headlines from a newspaper even to get them reading. And it is a problem. When I went in a few weeks ago to the library to talk to the prisoners, we were talking about using writing as therapy, really. Using writing anything down can be therapeutic, it can be cathartic. It certainly is for me. And I said to him, you know, you're not going to show this to anybody else, so the skills don't matter, the spelling doesn't really matter. Just get it down on paper. It's a way of dealing with it. Everything makes more sense, or your head is clearer once you've written it down on paper.
I want to talk about another character who's going to be familiar to fans of your books, who features in this book as well, Malcolm Fox. And he is, so obviously you wrote two or three books with just him, with Rebus perhaps coming in as sort of passing scenes. And then in later books, the two of them have been sort of vying for our attentions. And it felt different this time. And I'll explain why. So Rebus had always felt to me as, you know, this great detective, but one who sometimes takes great joy in antagonising senior officers. Whereas Malcolm, equally adept at solving mysteries, but always had a little bit of an eye on the corporate structure and not averse to, you know, laughing along with the boss because you never know what's gonna grease the pole to get you further up. This was the first time where I felt Malcolm came across as a direct antagonist to Rebus. And in one instance, without giving away any spoilers, is obstructive to the investigation. That felt deliberate. That felt like, oh, right, well, I am being directed down a certain alley here as far as Malcolm Fox is concerned. Just explain a bit more about him.
I mean, I haven't thought that I finished the Rebus series after Exit Music because Rebus had retired. I still wanted to write about cops, but I didn't want any readers to feel they were getting Rebus 2.0. So Fox suggested himself to me because he's a cop who investigates other cops, or he was at that time. So I thought, okay, nobody's going to think that's Rebus. You know, he's got to be whiter than white. He's got to stay the right side of the line because of the job that he does. He's a desk jockey. But he wants to be a man of action. He wishes he was a maverick, all of that kind of stuff. He's just not suited to it. And in several books, he tries to be a man of action and it goes badly wrong. So in this book, we find him. Yeah, I think it's like bringing Rebus back meant that Fox did go from being the protagonist to the antagonist. We are on Rebus's side. We like Rebus. We like the maverick. So we cannot like this guy who doesn't like him, who's trying to put him away. Well, in this book, he succeeded. And he comes to the prison partly to look on at the murder investigation, but also to gloat. He wants to see Rebus in Chokey. But on the outside, he is, you know, gets involved in the case, and this brings him closer to Special Branch in London. And yes, here's another pole for him to climb. He thinks, you know, Scotland's too small for me. I should be in London. I should be working at the Met. So maybe if I help this guy out in London with his kind of, you know, tracing gangsters and all the rest of it, that will get me the promotion I deserve. And I will bend the rules and do whatever it takes to get there. And so it becomes less and less likable as the book goes on, I think. I've grown out of love with the guy. What can I tell you? He's lucky he's still alive.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, I've had characters I've grown to dislike and I just bump them off. He's not been bumped off yet.
I think your audience are ahead of you. I think we took against him ages ago.
But he's a big bear of a guy, you know, in some way. And, oh, in the TV version, you know, they've made the, him and Siobhan are very close. And I thought, oh, I'm not sure about that. But then I had nothing to do with that.
And it's a very, and it's a different timeline. I was reading a piece in The Scotsman in which they were talking about the possibility of a rebus verse where...
the multiverse.
Yeah. Where there are different, the Rebus family, you know, maybe there's some 18th century Rebuses solving crimes and all this kind of stuff. Because Richard Rankin, the actor, amazingly, not any relation?
Not even his real name.
Oh, okay.
His name is Richard Harris.
Oh, okay. Well, you can't be an actor
exactly.
called Richard Harris.
Exactly.
So he...
I think it might be his mum's maiden name.
Okay. All right. But I think you've been quoted as saying it's a bit sweary and a bit violent.
Oh, I mean, terribly violent and very sweary. I was shocked to see it on the BBC, I'll be honest with you. My wife and I watched it in weekly installments. I'd never watched any of the rushes they sent me. I thought, I'm going to watch it in real time. I think my wife and I were the only people in the UK who didn't stream it. We just sat and watched it in weekly episodes. And, gosh, I was amazed that the swearing got through. Because it was originally, a lot of the money came from a Swedish streaming company, Viaplay. And they didn't mind the swearing because it was all going to be subtitled anyway. And the screenwriter, fantastic screenwriter, Gregory Burke, he put quite a lot of swearing in, more than I would have done. There's not much swearing in my books. The swearing happens in the gaps between what's going on. And the same with the violence. One of the things that attracted me to the crime novel writing about cops is the cops arrive after the violence has happened. But Gregory Burke puts it right in your face. So my wife and I were watching through our fingers some of the scenes. In fact, my wife left the room a couple of times when it was getting very violent. But it was visceral. But I just thought Richard Rankin was so good in it. I mean, I thought the writing was terrific. The dialogue was terrific. Richard Rankin is so charismatic, you can't take your eyes off him. And I'm going to forget his name, but the actor who played his brother. So what happened was that Greg Burke said to me, I think you threw away his brother too cheaply. You know, three or four books into the series, he suddenly disappears and that's him, he's gone. He said, there's so much you could do with that relationship between these two. They kind of hate and love each other and they could end up saving or destroying each other. And I thought, okay, go for it. And he said, I want to set it in the present day because I want to write about social issues and things that are going on right now. But I want a young, vigorous Rebus who can get in a fight, who can get into trouble, and believably so, not a 70-year-old guy that you use in your books. So I thought, well, that's going to be a hard ask for fans of the series. It might take 15, 20 minutes before it clicks. But he did a great job of it. And I did think the stuff with the brother was phenomenally good. So I was very happy with it. And I hope there's going to be a season two because he envisaged it as having a two-season arc, which is why it ends on a cliffhanger.
If you in general think it was too violent and too sweary, would they take note of that, do you think? I mean, or is it an independent beast?
Well, I am executive producer.
Well, there you go.
So
that means everything and nothing.
It means nothing. I mean, they asked me if I wanted a cameo, and I went, yeah, and I went along to the Oxford Bar, and I sat in the back room waiting for my cameo, and then they just went away. They forgot about me.
Really?
Yeah, really. And so,
how very dare
they. Oh, he was in the back. Oh, right, sorry.
They just forgot I was there, and they wrapped up, and he went away. And I went home, and I phoned up Greg Burke, and he said, no, they must have just forgotten about you.
Just one other thing.
Inspector.
Before we're done, yeah. Inspector, yes. Just before we go, it's my Columbo question. No, it's just a music question. One of the other characters, Jason Mulgrew, is introduced. I'm saying this is early on, which is why I put it on social media. I was just struck by the fact that his musical taste appears to be Pentangle, Fairport Convention and Burt Jansch. And that's you don't find many folkies being written about in 2024?
Possibly not, although there's been a comeback of sorts. There was a great triple CD that came out recently called something like Songs from Le Cousin, which was the London club in the 60s, and it was just all the artists who had played there. And that got people interested again. There's been biographies and autobiographies of all these artists. Younger people are getting attracted to singer-songwriters and great guitarists, male and female. So, no, I mean, I meet lots of people in their 20s and 30s who listen to, maybe not Pentangle and Fairport Convention per se.
My point.
But you know, they'll still go and see Richard Thompson in concert.
Yes.
When I go along to see a lot of these bands or these artists who are still with us and still gigging, I'm impressed at the, you know, how young some of the audience members are. Yeah. Even when I went to see Wishbone Ash a few weeks ago. Even Wishbone Ash.
It wouldn't be an Ian Rankin book without some music in there. Yeah. Anyway, that's what I'm thinking. There'll be more with Sir Ian on our companion podcast, which is the Q&A, which will be with you in a few short days. His new book is Midnight in Blue. Ian, thank you. A pleasure as ever.
Thank you.